I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Well, I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about one of the most important figures in American history, George Washington. But we're going to be doing it in light of our series on the American founding and America 250, the legacy of the American founding across the 250 years of America's history. When taking on the topic today, George Washington, is he the indispensable man? And for our conversation today, I'm joined by an old friend of this podcast, and many of our listeners know him, a terrific scholar, a terrific author, a terrific teacher, Dr. Steve Knott. For those of you who don't know him, and I can't believe there is anybody listening to this who doesn't, but if you don't know Steve, he is Professor Emeritus at the Naval War College. He was, of course, also co-chair of the Miller Center's Presidential Oral History Project, a terrific and important scholarly endeavor, and also the Thomas and Mabel Guy Professor of American History and Government at Ashland University. Steve has taught many courses and is teaching courses on the American presidency, the U.S. Constitution, and the American founding. Author of a number of really terrific books that I want to commend to our listeners if you have not yet read them, including particularly for this conversation, The Lost Soul of the American Presidency, and his book called Washington and Hamilton, The Alliance That Forged America. And as one special note, Steve is also the editor of the Ashbrook Center's volume, American Foreign Policy to 1899, which is a terrific collection of primary source documents. So we're talking today, folks, with someone who knows the American founding, who knows George Washington, and who knows the importance and influence of George Washington across American history. Steve, thanks for being with us.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Jeff, and I look forward to talking about our indispensable man.
Well, all right, let me start by being a contrarian, and I'll quote the one, well, at least it's attributed to one of the most famous contrarians of all time, Charles de Gaulle, who says, the graveyards are full of indispensable men. And the implication of that remark is, in political life, no one is really indispensable, particularly, we might say, Republican or Democratic political life that isn't focused on one person, a monarch or an emperor being in charge. But George Washington was called, has been called, and perhaps was called at the time of the founding, the indispensable man. What are we to make of de Gaulle's claim that maybe even for Washington, there really are no indispensable men?
Well, I'm a great admirer of Charles de Gaulle, Jeff, but I would have to disagree with de Gaulle on this point when it comes to George Washington. I simply don't see anyone in a position, both during the American Revolution and during the ratification period and during the critical first presidency of the new republic, being able to handle that job as adeptly as George Washington. Let me explain what I mean by that. I'm not sitting here arguing that George Washington, for instance, was a great general. I taught at a number of military institutions. I've encountered a number of military historians who can poke holes in Washington's tactical prowess and even perhaps his strategic thinking. But Washington understood something very critical during the Revolutionary War, which was that the Continental Army, if he could keep that army intact, the glorious cause had a chance to succeed. And while he lost far more battles than he won, one thing that comes through when you look at the correspondence of George Washington during the Revolutionary era is just this incredible perseverance, this incredible, almost superhuman patience with the delays that he encountered with first the Continental Congress and then the Confederation Congress, delays in terms of supplies, manpower, etc., leaks of classified information from Congress. This guy had the patience of Job, and that is exactly what was needed to go up against the world's greatest superpower. Somebody who understood keeping that army afloat was the key to success, and somebody who lobbied, I mean, lobbied doesn't even begin to capture the efforts that this man put into making sure that that army that he led was treated like an army. And I'm telling you, that in a way was a bigger challenge than facing the British on the battlefield. So I don't see any other general being able to replace George Washington. And then in the constitutional and presidential era, I don't see anybody with the reputation for integrity from north to south, which is an important point. This was a revered figure. He's one of the few. Maybe Ben Franklin shared that honor with him of being a national figure. But Washington was truly a national figure who could bind these 13 very separate colonies/states into the United States of America. I find him utterly indispensable.
Can we talk a little bit? Can we start with the first one? I'm very intrigued by that notion, the American Revolution. So as you said, a number of military strategists have said he lost a lot of battles. We sometimes forget that. He made some strategic decisions that were questionable at the time. And certainly looking backwards, hindsight of history, people have been critical of them. There were some detractors at the time of Washington's military while he was general. I'm thinking, for example, of General Lee.
Yes. Can
you say a little bit more about Washington's reputation as a leader during the American Revolution, including maybe some of those who were detractors?
Yeah, he did have some detractors, Jeff. And you're right about General Charles Lee. General Horatio Gates, the hero of Saratoga, though probably I would give that honor to Dan Morgan and Benedict Arnold. But nonetheless, General Gates was not a particular fan of George Washington. And then there was, of course, the famous Conway Cabal, which was probably not so much a cabal, but an effort made after Saratoga and after some of Washington's setbacks, I think at Brandywine and Morristown and elsewhere, to remove him. And there were some members of the Confederation Congress who shared, you know, the skepticism towards General Washington. Again, from my perspective, and from, I think, for the perspective of the time, the folks who backed George Washington, who stuck with him in a sense, understood how he was operating under a war by committee. In other words, there was no president, there was no centralized authority to help Washington conduct this war. Let me give you a very specific example of what I'm talking about. Whenever the war moved out of a particular region, the governors in those states and the citizenry in those states tended not to offer their support anymore for the Continental Army. So this was an army that kind of had to live by the seat of its pants.
It just sort of moved from place to place, getting support as it went, rather than having a steady support.
That's correct. And I do think both people in Washington's headquarters, people like Hamilton and others, and also some of the more observant members of the Congress, understood the constraints that this man was operating on, again, fighting the world's greatest superpower. Gates and General Lee and their supporters, I think, were either blind to this fact or chose not to see it for reasons that were perhaps less than noble.
His relations with Congress, you've mentioned they required an incredible amount of patience, and especially when I like your phrase, war by committee. That's not how we think of fighting war today when you think of the president as commander in chief of the Army and Navy. Tell us a little bit more about Washington's interactions with Congress. People like John Adams were famous for saying we have to help this man and his army out, and sort of often falling on deaf ears. How was Washington, what were his interactions with Congress like, and how was he able to maintain that relationship?
Yeah, it's a terrific question, Jeff, and it's an important one in that I would put at the top of that list the sort of quality that Washington brought to the table that allowed him to obtain enough of a support or base in Congress was that he always treated Congress with respect, always. no matter how frustrated he got, and I've got to tell you, not to beat a dead horse here, but going through his correspondence, I don't know how he maintained this composure, because it's, you know, you page after page in the papers of George Washington, literally begging for money, for shoes, for the basics. And he was always respectful to members of Congress. And I think that was appreciated. That was reciprocated by Adams and some of the others. They knew that this was a unique individual in the sense that he could have taken far more drastic measures, as was proposed at Newburgh, which we'll probably touch on in a sec here, to march on Congress. He never did that, but well beyond that, he always treated members of Congress with great respect, with a seeming deference, even at times when they were not giving him the very basics he needed to conduct a war against the world's largest superpower.
Do you find that his deference to Congress was expediency, or was it a commitment to Republican principles, or both?
Excellent question again. Yeah, I guess, Jeff, I would say it's a little bit of both, but perhaps I'd put more weight on this was a guy who had absorbed, understood what this glorious cause was truly about, that we were going to do things differently here. And if we lost that aspect of it, if we abandoned our principles in order to somehow win through less than Republican means, for lack of a better term, we were selling ourselves out. And so I see a man committed to principle here, committed to the glorious cause, understanding that he was on the edge, on the precipice of a truly world historic moment, and that preserving that republicanism was critical to ennobling this cause that he was leading.
So we see, of course, we see that during the course of the fighting, during the course of the war, that kind of commitment to Republican principles, personal bravery,
yes,
willing to sacrifice, be away from Mount Vernon, be away from home and all the comforts of home. And then at the end of the war, there is this remarkable moment, which you've mentioned already, and I think it's portrayed vividly in the rotunda of the Capitol building, in fact. That we see another part of George Washington's character once the war, the fighting at least, has concluded.
Yeah, that's right. So in the spring of 1783, so Yorktown is October 1781, this kind of an uneasy truce that exists for well into 1783. Negotiations are going on in Paris, but Washington's army is still encamped outside of New York City, where the British are maintaining their headquarters in North America. This is where the Newburgh insurrection, if you want to call it that, takes place. Washington puts it down in no uncertain terms, again, arguing that what we are involved in here is truly a unique in the annals of human history, and we are not going to sully it by marching on Congress at gunpoint for our back pay. That's episode one. Episode two is when the Treaty of Paris is finally signed, the war formally comes to a close, and in December of 1783, Washington travels to Annapolis and literally hands his sword back to the Confederation Congress. And, you know, there were statesmen in Europe who were just stunned at this, because, again, this was a man who could have put private interest over public interest, over the common good, could have easily obtained a complete power had he sought it. And yet here he is handing his sword back to his civilian overseers, whom, as I just mentioned, had made his life difficult for the
previous
8 years.
Yeah, and was there precedent for that? Because so much of what George Washington seemed to experience in the new America was unprecedented. He was really the person in many ways setting some precedents. Was it a typical thing for a commander to literally hand over their sword to this civilian body?
It's possible, Jeff, and you'd be stronger on this point than I would be. Washington was a great admirer of some of the Romans and, admired that notion of Cincinnatus and, you know, the warrior farmer returning to his plow. I don't know my history well enough. I'm not like you, Jeff. You're well versed in this kind of stuff. But it's possible there are precedents. But if there are, there certainly were not any modern precedents or closer to Washington's time that I'm aware of.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right, actually. That sets the stage, of course, for him to return to Mount Vernon in the 1780s. And then he is called back into the service of his country starting in the mid-1780s, leading to the Constitutional Convention. Why did Washington end up going to the Constitutional Convention, and what was his role there?
Both James Madison, fellow Virginian, and Alexander Hamilton, a former staff officer, are lobbying Washington pretty extensively by the time you get to 1784, 1785, that something needs to be done, that while we've won the war, we're in danger of losing the peace. And that lobbying is part of the reason why Washington agrees. But I want to add something that I think is often overlooked, Jeff. Washington wrote something called the Circular Letter to the States in June of 1783, during that period between Newburgh and handing his sword over in Annapolis, in which he outlines, he cites some of the problems, some of the inadequacies of the Confederation, and makes something of a timid, not timid, but diplomatic pitch for a strengthened central government. And so, I think there's a tendency, maybe even I'm guilty of it, to put a lot of focus on Madison and Hamilton's efforts to convince Washington to go to Philadelphia. But I think the seeds are already there in Washington's mind, 4 years before the Constitutional Convention. This isn't working. We need a strengthened central government. We need to pay our debts to great powers of Europe so that we can develop a good credit rating as a new nation. We need to have a strong military that's not rooted on state-based militias. It's all there in that circular letter to the states. So Washington is already thinking about this long before he's being lobbied to go to Philadelphia. While he's in Philadelphia, Jeff, this is where, for me again, he's the indispensable man. He's elected to preside over the convention. He's trusted by the delegates. Again, he and Franklin are the two national figures that have a kind of national reputation. And I can't see anybody else sitting in that chair, possible exception of Franklin, who would have carried the same weight and who would have reassured the public outside those closed doors of the Constitutional Convention, that the proceedings that were going on there in secret could be trusted because you can trust George Washington.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because it seems like here, the opponents of this new constitution or the whole movement toward a new constitution, of course, are making arguments. This could be the reestablishment of aristocracy, a kind of secret monarchy. We can't trust this. What's happening? How much does Washington's known commitment to the glorious cause of republicanism allow the Constitutional Convention to do its deliberations in secret?
Yeah, again, Jeff, I think it's absolutely critical. I don't see anyone in that room, possibly Franklin, although I have to note, Franklin, I think, is 82 at this time, so he's not at the top of his game. Washington, I think, is in his 50s at this point. There's just no question that the whole credibility of those proceedings rest, in my view, on the presence of George Washington. Now, let me make it clear. I don't want your listeners to mistake what I'm saying. He's not particularly active. He does not speak up
Yeah, I
all
was going
that
to ask
often.
that. Does it what his role in actually managing the discussion and debate and sometimes fractious debate at the convention?
It's a lot of procedural decisions, which are incredibly important in sensitive meetings like that. I don't want to underplay that, but he does not particularly speak up all that much. Again, I think seeing himself as kind of a neutral arbiter, the guy in the chair who's got to call balls and strikes, absolutely critical role. But Jeff, you touched on something very important about Washington that does not get the attention it deserves. This was a man, both as a general and as a president and presiding over the convention, who believes in secrecy, who believes that in order for good decisions to be made, transparency is not always the answer. Reading the tea leaves, gauging public opinion is not the answer. You need people willing to speak up and speak honestly. And sometimes folks are not willing to do that in a public setting. So this is an aspect of Washington. It's a thread of Washington's life, this belief in the importance of secrecy, whether it's to military success. Washington had an incredible intelligence organization during the Revolutionary War called the Culper Ring. But it's also critical to the success of the convention, and I would argue to the success of his presidency.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
His character, we know his character publicly at the convention. What about his personal character and his interaction with the delegates to the Constitutional Convention? What do we know about that and whether that at all was important in the success of the convention?
Well, I think it was very important, Jeff, but I would also say this. Washington is not... It would be a mistake for your listeners to view him, I mean, and I'm sure most folks don't, as warm and fuzzy and cuddly.
He didn't have that reputation, did he?
No, he loved to dance with the ladies, whether it was Eliza Hamilton at Valley Forge or wherever. He loved to dance. He loved the theater. But he's not a backslapper. Not that a lot of them back then were, although Franklin maybe comes close. He's still somewhat distant, but maybe the better way to put it, Jeff, is this is a man who spent a lot of his life, particularly as a younger man, thinking about how best to lead. And what he came to the conclusion was that dignity was critical, that one had to conduct oneself in a very dignified manner. And that does not include, you know, being the life of the party. That a certain distance, a certain detachment has its place, whether as a military or a political leader, in terms of fostering respect in your audience, whether it's an audience of soldiers or political figures. So this is a man very aware of how he is projecting himself.
Do we know anything about, particularly during the Constitutional Convention, but maybe even during the Revolution, anything about did Washington ever let his guard down? He ever in private show his particular characteristics, his emotions to individuals, maybe besides his wife? Do we know anything about
that? Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, arguably his closest advisor, Alexander Hamilton, in terms of the presidential years, and then a close staff officer during the war, Hamilton. Hamilton and Washington had a blow up in early 1781. Hamilton had been itching for a combat command. Washington felt he needed Hamilton in the staff headquarters. Hamilton was an incredible staff officer, fluent in French, could work around the clock seemingly. But Hamilton, being a young guy, wanted to get out there and fight. And there was a confrontation between the two of them in which, according to Hamilton, Washington lost his cool snapped at him for keeping him waiting. In other words, Washington had asked to see Hamilton. Hamilton was speaking with General Lafayette, chatted for 10 or 15 minutes, then went in to see the General Washington, and Washington snapped at him, according to Hamilton. Hamilton, being a young guy with a pretty thin skin, storms out of the headquarters. Now, I point that out in part. Hamilton is not the only one to mention George Washington's temper. And Washington knew this. He was aware that he had something of a short fuse. But again, he worked on it for the bulk of his life to kind of rein that temper in. That's the one thing that comes to mind, Jeff, with your question. But let me add one other story from the Constitutional Convention. I don't think it's apocryphal, but sometimes it sounds so good, I'm not sure. But Hamilton supposedly puts Gouverneur Morris up to another delegate, prominent delegate at the convention. The two of them have a bet. Hamilton puts Morris up to going up to General Washington and slapping him on the back.
Okay.
Kind of wrapping his arm around him. And Morris thought he could pull this off. Hamilton, knowing Washington, I think much better than Morris, told him, you know, this is going to go down in flames. Morris goes up, whacks Washington on the back, and apparently the look that Washington shoots Morris is one that neither of the men involved will ever forget.
And to cast a withering glance at Gouverneur Morris and have him be withered by it, that's quite an accomplishment.
Correct. Yeah, because this was a man with an outsized ego and full of himself.
What about as president? Because, of course, the Constitutional Convention produces the Constitution, Article 2, the presidency. And in fact, there's anti-federalists at the time arguing against the ratification, saying specifically, the Article 2 has given us what they call the fetus of monarchy. And the only way you're getting away with this is because you're hiding behind the good name of George Washington, who everybody knows will be the first president. But after him, it'll be a legion of scoundrels.
Yeah.
And you're setting up a terrible precedent that Washington himself might not be aware that he's supporting this, but this is what it will lead to. So talk to us about Washington assuming the presidency under Article 2 of the Constitution.
Yeah, Washington approaches this as usual with a great amount of, he spends weeks and months thinking about how best to take this new, somewhat historically unique responsibility. And he's communicating with Madison, he's communicating with Hamilton, there's a lot of references to dignity, but Washington's trying to figure out how close should he get to the people? Should he shake hands with them? Should he bow? We take this stuff for granted today, but they're trying to create a new order for the ages and a new office for the ages. And I can't think of a better person to think long and hard about how to do that than George Washington. Now, he adopts some elements of a kind of British formality. You know, there's no shaking of hands, there's bowing. He holds these weekly levees with members of Congress and with the public. But there's definitely a formality, there's definitely a distance, there's definitely a detachment. But during his presidency, Washington makes three tours of the nation, months on end, particularly one into the Deep South. And the point of those tours was to show the American people that they had nothing to fear from this new office. They had certainly had nothing to fear from him. And it was, in a sense, showing the flag, trying to convince the American people not only to not have any fears, but to think of themselves as Americans. To give up, not give up, but to at least give perhaps equal standing to seeing yourself a citizen of the United States as well as a citizen of Georgia. And Washington, I believe, during his 8 years of the presidency, one of his greatest accomplishments is convincing Americans to think continentally, as Hamilton put it, to think beyond the parochial, but also and to think of themselves as Americans. And to have pride in this new nation and to, in a sense, go above and beyond their local or parochial interests. And again, Jeff, I don't see Hamilton being able to pull that off. I don't see Jefferson. I don't see Madison. The kind of names that you and I know and your listeners know, they're not really household names in 1790. So Washington is indispensable in terms of convincing the American public not to fear this new constitution, not to fear the office of the presidency, and be proud to be Americans.
Can say a little, I'm really taken by that point, Steve. Say a little, if you don't mind, to talk a little bit more about how Washington approached the office of president as a constitutional office, which, yeah, as you've written, has unfortunately in modern times, many, many presidents have not had held it in such regard.
Yeah, great question, Jeff. Look, Washington does not see his Article II power as coming from a mandate from the people. He sees his Article II powers coming from the Constitution, from Article II of the Constitution. And he takes his oath in front of the public, but I'm not sure how many Americans are aware of this. When he goes in to deliver his inaugural address, it's just to the Congress and to the ambassadorial corps and to some governors. It's not in front of the people. So that may sound...
I didn't know that.
Yeah. The oath is public, but then they proceed into the chamber and close the doors. And it's a somewhat minor thing, but it's symbolic of this idea that my power does not, as much as I'm concerned about those folks outside the doors here, and as much as they admire me and this whole revolution, in a sense, was for them, my authority comes from the Constitution, and my dealings as president are going to be with you, the American Congress, arguably the Supreme Court. Not, you know, we're not going to be hashing these issues out on the street corner. This is not a populist presidency. This is a presidency rooted in the Constitution. This is a presidency devoted to the rule of law. And you can see that, by the way, Jeff, in his handling of the Whiskey Rebellion, which was very popular in a lot of sections of the United States. But Washington believed his oath to take care that the laws be faithfully executed overrode any sort of popular sentiment about attacks on whiskey. So Washington is all about the Constitution and the rule of law.
And I'm even thinking of course, incredibly important constitutional precedents like serving two terms.
Yes.
Which, of course, now has been enshrined in the Constitution through amendment. What was Washington's thinking about that? Because sometimes what you hear is, well, look, he was just only going to serve two terms because he just wanted to get back to Mount Vernon. And so that was the thing. That was really the only thing that was motivating him. Did he? Of course, we know he loved Mount Vernon. Of course, we know he wanted to be there. And he had served his country in public service for many years. But was he also thinking of the constitutional or Republican precedent?
I think so, Jeff. Absolutely. And the evidence for that is that Hamilton actually pleaded with him to run for a third term. And that's not always all that well known. Washington did want to go back to Mount Vernon, but I do think he was so aware, always aware, that he was setting precedents. And he absolutely believed it was essential that turnover was essential for a healthy Republican government. So I see that decision. Yeah, he wanted to go sit under the fig trees at Mount Vernon, but he understood this was critical to a healthy Republican order.
It seems like another element, once he's at the end of his presidency, that in which he was so vital to the Republic, and it's a tradition that certainly has continued today with presidents, which is a farewell address.
Yes.
And it's a remarkable document. Many of our listeners have had a chance to study a little bit, at least. But for our listeners who we want a deeper understanding of it, how important is Washington's farewell address for American public life?
Incredibly important, Jeff. Perhaps less so in our day, but throughout much of American history, school children well up into the early 20th century would always read the farewell address. It was definitely up there with the Gettysburg Address and the Declaration of Independence. For whatever reason, we've lost it a little bit. I wish we could restore it to its previous prominence. But that address, which, by the way, was a cooperative effort between Hamilton and Washington, with Hamilton serving as something of the wordsmith, Washington definitely maintaining editorial control over all of it. Another thing worth mentioning, Jeff, Washington had actually written the first draft of a farewell address that was, unfortunately, somewhat, it was out of character. It was somewhat bitter, resentful about the attacks, questioning his patriotism that had come during the second term, particularly in and around the Jay Treaty. Thankfully, he had the wherewithal, the understanding, the political acumen to scrap that, to turn to Hamilton. The two of them in the summer of 1796 are going back and forth with these drafts, very much a collaborative effort. And again, what you see there, Jeff, is this appeal to national unity, this appeal for the American people to think of themselves as Americans, not as New Yorkers or Virginians, to abandon the parochial. I haven't used this term, and I should have used it earlier. Maybe I did. I don't think. Disinterestedness. In other words, all of us.
Yeah, that's a curious term. What do you mean by that, Steve?
Sure. I've said that to some students sometimes, and they think, you mean he didn't care?
Yeah. Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, it's this idea that I think that was at the heart of Washington's political philosophy of the putting the common good before personal or private interest. In other words, he's trying to set a standard both for political leaders and for citizens of emphasizing selfless duty over self-interest. And again, I think you can see this repeatedly throughout his life. The moments he had opportunities to seize power, he never did it. He could have benefited financially from his public service. He never accepted a salary while he was commander of the Continental Army, for instance. So there's these constant examples of personal sacrifice, of avoiding any what today we might call conflicts of interest, okay, and always keeping the national interest first and foremost. I'm not sitting here saying this man was a saint. There might be folks out there who are aware that, you know, in terms of his quest for property, and as a young surveyor, the guy had an insatiable appetite for property. Yes. Did he own slaves? Absolutely. I wish he had taken more serious action steps on that front beyond just freeing the slaves in his will. But I would still argue, well aware of those caveats, this was a man who put the public interest before the private interest repeatedly throughout his career. And that's why you and I are sitting here today talking about the United States and about his contributions.
Yeah, that seems to me like my concluding question to you. And maybe it's an unfair question, but without George Washington, would America have become the nation that it became?
I really don't think so, Jeff. I see, and obviously this is counterfactual, but I don't see our republic surviving. I mean, as it was, I'd say it was touch and go, both starting with the Revolution and up through the 1790s. Your audience needs to be aware of just how deeply split the American public was between so-called Jeffersonians and Hamiltonians. And yet Washington is the one bridge between those two intellectual giants, Jefferson and Hamilton. But Washington's the guy who makes it happen. I don't see it happening without him. And his legacy, God bless him, in my view, we need to restore some aspects of it that have been lost.
So at least one graveyard does have an indispensable man.
I think that's absolutely right, Jeff. I really do. And I'm glad you started with that, because we live in an era where the so-called great man or great woman theory of history has been certainly diminished with some good reason. History is always a collection of all sorts of forces at work, and it's a mistake to just focus on the very top But if there's ever a case to be made that where you pull this man out of the equation, I just don't see anybody in a position to step in, to keep that army alive, to bring 13 very separate colonies together, and to launch a new government that in some shape or form exists to this day. I will go to my grave believing he was the indispensable man. With all due respect to Charles de Gaulle.
For our listeners who want to get to know George Washington a little bit better, I know it's unfair to ask sort of what's one thing they should read, but I have to ask that question of you, a scholar who studied George Washington. If there is something that you say, here's some insight into the heart and mind of this man, what would you recommend for them?
Well, it's funny, Jeff. One that immediately comes to mind, at this point, it's probably at least 20 or 30 years old, but it's David Hackett Fisher's Washington's Crossing. It focuses on Washington as a military leader, but it really is about the transfer, the crossing that Washington engages is not just crossing the Delaware into Trenton, but a kind of crossing or transformation of this somewhat parochial Virginian member of the Virginia gentry into a leader of a nation. And he learns to work with soldiers from New England who are completely different. New Englanders less likely to follow orders. I'm speaking to you from New England, so I'm well aware of that. but it may sound like an odd choice because the focus seems to be Washington as a military leader, but it's much more than that. It's the biography of a man who learns throughout his life leadership lessons and continues to learn and continues to in a sense look at himself, which is not an easy thing for people to do. So I would recommend Hackett Fisher's Washington's Crossing. And I guess I'm trying to think, I don't want to plug any of my own.
No, I mean, you've got some great books, Steve, on this subject.
The book Washington and Hamilton, I think, talks about the importance of that alliance between what I consider to be the two key founders. And those of you who know me know that I'm a big fan of Hamilton, but even I have to acknowledge in the end, and I do in that book, Tony Williams and I do in that book, acknowledge that none of this happens without Washington. So if you're looking for a more popular read, it's a very easy read. I would say Washington and Hamilton by Knott and Williams.
Fabulous. Well, thank you. I mean, this is important insight and reminder for us of the importance of leadership of a certain character and kind for our constitutional republic. Steve Knott, thanks for being with us so much today on The American Idea.
Thanks, Jeff. I loved it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.